Station number 8721, Wheel 4.
Mr. Baker, Reel 4. Could you continue your account of the fighting at Anzac?
Yes. After Captain Richards had ordered me to move to the left, we then fired away at all the Turks who kept advancing, and they were then about 150 yards away, and they came up in almost mass formation, so we had very easy targets. And next to me, there was a space, an Australian. He came and laid next to me. On his right, another man scaled this steep slope, and he turned out to be Major Armstrong of the Portsmouth Battalion, Royal Marines. Why he was there, I don't know. Captain Richards was next to him, and all the way to the right were men shoulder to shoulder lying on the ground.
There wasn't any cover then? You weren't in an...
No cover at all. There were no trenches or anything like that. They were just lying like the top of a railway embankment then, on the very ridge. Suddenly, a machine gun crackled away. At right angles to us, we were firing ahead, and it was more than right angles. It was even behind that, because you see, we had this horseshoe position, and the Turks could get at us from two sides and the front. This machine gun came along, and that killed every man up on the ridge except the Australian and me. We were the only two left up on the ridge. And the Australian said to me, "Oh," he said, "the bastards can't kill me." He said, "They've had lots of tries." He said, "They can't kill me." I looked again along. The machine gun started barking away again behind us, and that came along, and that was knocking the sand up, and that covered every man again. Every man. It came right along, and that just left the Aussie and me. And I felt the bullets thud into the Aussie, and he never spoke again. And I felt as though I'd been kicked by a donkey, and I had a bullet through the right foot. Well, that wiped out the whole lot again. And Turks...
What did you feel when you saw the machine gun coming towards you?
Yes, when I saw these bullets coming along, and I knew that it would be the end of me if they came along far enough. And they say your past comes up when you think you were going to die, but I can say truthfully that I hadn't got very much past at 19, and... all I thought was, am I going to live? That's all I thought. That's how it struck me. Am I going to be lucky? Because I couldn't see how I could be with all these bullets coming along. And I waited for it, as though it was inevitable. But for some reason or other, the gun stopped at the Aussie and my right foot. And he never spoke any more. Well, I laid there, and I didn't know quite what to do. The Turks came along, those that were left forward of us, and they prodded various men with their bayonets. Fortunately, they didn't poke me, otherwise I shouldn't be here now. And I could hear them jabbering away, and they moved away again. Well, I thought, well, I must do something, so I gave myself a push off, and I went bumpity-bump right down to the bottom of the ravine, over dead men and rifles and all kinds of things and bush, and bumped off right down to the bottom. Down the bottom, you were almost as safe as houses, except for shrapnel. And a New Zealander, he picked me up, and he dressed my wound, and he put me on a donkey, which he was taking the wounded down the shrapnel valley to the to the ships on the shore there, waiting on the offshore to load us up. And there were no hospital ships at all.
Do you remember anything about this New Zealander with a donkey? Because it was quite a famous... Do you remember anything about this New Zealander with a donkey? Because there was quite a famous individual doing that rescue work, and it might have been him.
It could easily have been. No, I can't say who he was. Although, I've got his New Testament somewhere. Even today, I can't find it. I remember his name. Yes, David Taylor. And... I can't think of his name, but it's South Island, and but I can remember him, and that was his name. And he took me down on the donkey to the beach. That was the best donkey ride I've ever had. As you can gamble on that. We got down to the beach, and of course there was no landing stages, only a few big chunks of rock which they'd made a sort of tiny landing place, where the ship's boats could pull in and load up the wounded. And anyway, they loaded us up, and a middy came along with four boats and picked up the wounded, and he towed us out to the Dongola, which was a trooper that the Aussies had came over in. And... they were using that for the wounded. We got alongside the ship, and somebody up on deck came along with a bucket of water and shot it down the chute, and it spilt all over us who were in the boat. A good target. He didn't realise what he'd done, but the little middy, who was about 16, he blasted him some of the finest language I've ever heard. And really good to listen to. But, you know, although you were not feeling very happy, you couldn't help but chuckle. And finally they got us on board. And on the ship were only two doctors, no medical staff of any kind at all, no nurses or anything like that. And the crew had to act as orderlies. And on this ship...
Can I break off here? Because I want to ask you a couple more questions about Anzac, the actual fighting, the early fighting. We'll come back to the hospital ship, the Dongola, rather.
Yes.
During the fighting, did you have any machine guns with you?
Guns, I had forgotten the machine guns. The Turks had wonderful machine guns. We were equipped with 12 Boer War-type Maxims. And they had water-cooled... they were water-cooled. And we hadn't got one gun left after the first day ashore. We were completely without machine gun at all. After the first day, we hadn't got a gun left.
They broke down.
We were then... That was the battalion's lot were gone, and the officer as well. Maurice Curtin, the officer, he was killed as well, and all his guns were gone. And we were then reduced to our own rifles. That's all we'd got. And we hadn't got any artillery backing us at all. No artillery ashore.
When you were doing this business of having rifles loaded up for you and continual firing, did the rifles not get very hot?
They got very hot until I couldn't fire them. And had to wait till the first one cooled off. But by then, we'd quelled the attack. Otherwise, it could have been very, very sticky. Because, you see, you know, when you can't hold your rifle, you're snookered. And they got ever so hot. And it doesn't take long, many rounds for them to get very hot, you know.
Did they jam at all?
No. Didn't jam one. Too hot to hold.
Did any of the men involved, or yourself, involved in this sort of quick fire, did any of them betray any sort of... Did they get excited or bloodlust or anything, or was it just a job?
They all were only too glad to keep alive and bob down. You know, get as many rounds off as they could when they heard them on the move, you see, and the officer, he, told us what to do. And But after a time, he stopped one, and we had to do what we thought.
Was the fighting very confused during this period at Anzac? Did you know exactly what was happening, or was it rather confusing?
No, it was more I would say you had to make your own decisions, really, in a way. When you saw Turks, you knew you'd got to kill them. You see, that was all there was to it. There was next to no leadership, you know, because, you see, as I say, Richards, he was killed, and our adjutant, he was killed two away from me, you see, and there was nobody left up there then to take over at all. We were completely wiped out, and they said that when we had that bad setback, up went another lot, and they were caught again by the same machine gun and wiped out again. They reckon there were 52 of us in that section, and then up came all this other lot, and they got wiped out again, right on the toe. And I think that after that, I don't know, mind you, but I think after a time they found out where this one was with the machine gun, the enfilader, and they shot him up.
Was this enfilader? Am I right in understanding it was from the right back?
From the right. We were like that, you see. And he was squatting us from about there, slightly behind our toe position.
And on the right?
Yes, he was on the right. And he came right along with it, you see. And, of course, he had a good view of us because he was higher up, you see. And he could see what exactly he was doing. Oh, yes. That was like mowing grass, I should think, for him. Easily.
Did you get any rations or water brought up to you during any of this period at Anzac?
Oh, no. It was bad for water. Very bad. You see, the water had to come from Egypt. And we were very, very dry. Yeah. And, of course, the excitement makes one very dry, you know. And there plenty of times, you see, the short time I was there, we were completely dried out, had no water at all. And one night, it rained, and, you know, I was drinking water out of little holes in the rocks. Yes, glad to drink a drop of that, you know. Really dry. There's nothing worse than being thirsty. No, I didn't mind being hungry, but thirsty. You see, you don't have any appetite, you know, really. When you're in excitement, you don't have any appetite at all, but you're very, very thirsty. Yes. And as I say, there was no water there. There was no water available at all, only what was brought up from Egypt in cans, 600 miles away. It was an operation which was, to say the least, very, very badly planned. And that's, and I'm only an amateur at it, but I could have handled it much better.
Can you give me a sort of picture of what the Anzac terrain was like?
The Anzac terrain?
Yes. How steep was all?
Now, the Anzac terrain is very similar to the northwest of Scotland, up towards Ullapool on that side, and southern from Ullapool. You find very ragged and rocky areas and covered in scrub and bush. And that in itself is very similar to Gallipoli. And it's the only place that I've ever seen, you know, which is similar. Very similar it is in. And you could almost imagine you were in Gallipoli. But Gallipoli was much more rugged and there was so much of it, acres of it, you see. Acres. It was a foolhardy operation from the word go.
What did you think of the Australian? You mentioned the Australian you met who got killed next to you, but
yes.
Did you see enough of the Australians and New Zealanders to form an opinion of their fighting merit?
Absolutely, yes, I did. I saw one of the bravest acts I've ever seen, and I was only there a few days, as you know, with them, but there was a sniper. He was picking up men after man, he was picking up. And He, an Australian, he ran along the top of the ridge, mind you, in full view of the Turks, carrying a dummy on his back. This was at, when it was just beginning to get dark. He ran along the top of the ridge with a dummy on his back to provide, attraction for this sniper to have a go at him, which he did. He had a go, and we were watching to see where where he did fire from, because you could see the flash, you see. And we found that he was up at a tree, and all of us who could fire, you know, could be relied on to hit something. We fired up into this tree when we saw this flash, and he was dressed in green. And this Aussie, he really attracted his fire so that we could shoot him up. And that's the bravest thing I've ever seen. I wouldn't have done it for all the tea in China. But he ran along the top there with his dummy on his back. Cool. In full view, mind you, of the sniper and others. But he got away with it. Cool. But in general, the Australians were a good lot of fighters. And, really good lot of men. They were entirely different to our troops. You see, they called their officers Bill and Joe and all that kind of thing. No sir attached to their men at all. Oh, no. Yeah, they just called them by their Christian names. Mm. And they were great fellows. I've got a great admiration for the Australians and New Zealanders.
Could you tell me something about conditions on the Dongola?
Yes. We were taken aboard the ship, and we were deposited on the bare deck. There were no beds, of course, and just one blanket each to cover ourselves over with. Those who were badly wounded were attended to by the two doctors who were on board. Two doctors only for over 600 wounded.
Were there any other medical personnel?
No medical staff, as far as I can remember, at all. The ship's company looked after the wounded. I can't recall anyone at all who was in any way RAMC. Not anyone at all. We were fed, truly, you know, just not very well. And they brought us drink and things like that. But some were quite immobile, some of these men. But fortunately, I was only wounded in the foot and I could get along on my backside, you see. Two hands and slide along, you know. And I went up on deck, and I went up on the bridge with the captain, and he thought it was great. So did I, to be up on the bridge. And we had no attention whatsoever until 3 days after we'd left Gallipoli. We had no one to look at us at all. My wound had gone completely black, you know, with bruising, and ever so badly swollen. And I was nearly then down to Alexandria by the time they looked at me. And on the way down, the ship kept stopping and burying, burial services over the side, dropping people off. And who died on the way down. She stopped at least three times. And we got down to Alex, and
What were sanitary conditions about? Because it must have been difficult for the immobile ones
They were in poor shape, and they were attended to as well as these ship's personnel could handle them. Yeah, but I wasn't bothered that way, because, I could get up on my backside, you see. And I had no bother at all. But quite a number of them did, as you can imagine, and it got in a very poor state between decks. And there were not dozens, but there were scores of us, you see, that were wounded in the legs and in the arms. Anyone who got a really bad one, they were treated upstairs somewhere, up on the upper deck, some area there. But there were no beds at all, no beds whatsoever, because, you see, all the troops had come over in hammocks. And as you know, when you're wounded, you can't get in a hammock. That's bad enough to get in there when you're fit, leave alone when you're in a poor state. And that we were all lying about all over the deck.
Were you in great discomfort yourself from your wound?
Oh, yes. But after being ashore, you know, and lying in on the ground and being rough there, you were safe. And that was worth a lot to be, you know, to be safe. You knew you were not going to be shot up when you were on the deck, and you could put up with quite a lot.
Did you feel resentment at the lack of medical attention?
Well, yes, we did, because we knew that the powers that be at the top should have known that they were in for very heavy casualties. And they evidently didn't understand the position at all. The operation in the main, in my opinion, was very badly handled from the top. Boy Scouts could have handled it just as well, I think. For one thing, you see, they chose the wrong places to land, in my opinion. They were more or less impossible landing places. And easily to guard, very easy to guard they were. It's a wonder that anybody ever got ashore. But up at Gaba Tepe, where I landed with the Australians, it was much easier up there. They could have defended it better if they'd have thought it was the landing would have been there. But it was fairly open. There was very little opposition, you know, at Gaba Tepe, where Anzac, as they call it, very little opposition in at all. And the Australians went right in, well, about, I suppose, 2.5 miles in this big ravine. And they manned the whole of the top, which was like a giant railway embankment, really, the position. Horseshoe with the two ends resting on the sea. That was the position at Anzac. And, of course, the Turks could fire in all directions at you. You had frontal fire, enfilade fire. You see, they got you in all directions. So you were not only firing to the front, you were being fired at from the side, and in some cases almost from behind. You see, you were in a vulnerable position there. And had they had more troops, I think the Australians would have been swept into the sea. But they hadn't got them. Fortunately for us, there was a great lack of communication because, see, there are no real roads there. They're only just tracks. And they couldn't bring along any heavy stuff to bombard you with because they hadn't got it there. So it was chiefly small gunfire and rifles and very good machine guns. Their machine guns were ever so much better than ours. We had Boer War equipment, that was Maxims. We had 12 machine guns to our battalion. And after the first day, we hadn't got one left. They were water-cooled. And all of them were just scrap, so we were left with rifles only. The Turks had a limited quantity of hand grenades. We hadn't got any of those at all. I'd never seen a hand grenade in those days. And, we were at a great disadvantage. Well, now, to get to the Dongola, she was a troop ship for the Australians, and she'd stood offshore waiting, you know, to pick up the wounded, to be used as a temporary hospital ship. We got down to Alexandria, and there was a new, brand new hospital ship had arrived there. They said that all the hospitals in Egypt were full up with wounded, and we were loaded straight onto this ship, the Letitia, and off we went on our way back to England.
Did you ever fear that you'd lose your foot or part of your lower? Did you ever think you might have to have your foot amputated?
No, I'll tell you what I did think. When I had that wound in the right foot, that was my deadly foot at football. I used to take the penalties with that. I wondered how it was going to shape. But anyway, after they'd given me a check-up, you know, on the Letitia, I could see then that it was going to be good and be all right. And the ship's doctor, he said that would be all right. I said, do you think I'll be able to take penalties again? He said, oh, yes. He said, you will in time. Anyway, we then left Alexandria and started for home. We got within 60 miles of Jib when it was foggy. I thought we'd run aground, but we'd run into a small Italian ship, which they said went down in 5 minutes. We continued slowly toward Jib with the bows badly dented and also leaking, and they said by the time we got to Jib there was 12 feet of water in the front hold, you know, completely filled up. And we got to Jib. They then welded on a forced bow. We were there a few days and they welded on a forced bow, and we then started back for the old country. We came up towards the Bay of Biscay and the weather really got rough. And we went through the bay. It was even rougher than it was the first time I'd crossed it. I wondered if the false bow would hang on, but evidently they knew how to do it, and it did. We finally arrived back in England on the 21st of May, and I was sent up to Birmingham University at Selly Oak. That was called the First Southern General Hospital. They turned the university buildings into a hospital. And I was only in there a few days. And I was then sent to George Cadbury's summer residence at Rednall, which is quite near Birmingham. And he'd let that to the government, you know, for a convalescent home. And I was there about a fortnight, I suppose. Went back. Then had a week's leave, went back to barracks. And
could I ask you about the week's leave? Because when you went on this leave, were you treated in any special way as a returning hero or anything, or were you just treated normally?
Well, no, not really, no. People wanted to know, you know, what it was like, because I was the first casualty in our village. I was the first one, and I was wounded on May the 3rd. And I happened to be the very first casualty, so of course it all went round. And everybody I met wanted to know what it was like, and I told them it was some kind of hell, which it was. And so...
Did they seem to understand what it was like when you told them?
No, they did not. It was impossible to tell them really just how it was. You told them the story of how men were at one moment were alive and the next moment they were dead. You know, it was just like that, because I explained to them how I wouldn't have been there then had I laid where I laid first of all, you see. And I moved about 2 yards, that was all. That was just 2 yards between me and death. I wouldn't have been there. Well, I wouldn't have been here now. And people didn't seem to realise, you know, what a terrible thing war was. They didn't. You couldn't convey, you know, the awful state of things where you live like animals and behave like animals. They just didn't understand it. I never met up with one person who seemed to understand.